This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The law professor speaks at ISU tonight about his advice to anyone encountering police. Don't say anything without an attorney present.
They start giving information that they think will be used to prosecute somebody else, and then they find that the evidence is actually used against them as well.
James DeWayne's YouTube video, Don't Talk to the Police, has millions of views. He'll talk to GLT's Judy Valente ahead of his appearance. Here's something you don't hear much about at Bloomington's landlocked District 87 schools, expansion. But that's what's on tap. Superintendent Barry Riley lays it all out in an interview with Charlie Schlenker. And as the Illinois Symphony Orchestra continues its search for a new director, you'll hear from another of the candidates for the position presenting Springtime with Gershwin this weekend. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 19th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. District 87 schools are planning a fine arts addition to Bloomington High School. The need for the $7.5 million expenditure adding to the east side of BHS has its roots in a decision 5 years ago. Music teachers suggested busing fifth grade kids to the junior high for band and orchestra lessons every weekday. Before that, Superintendent Barry Riley says they had to meet in inadequate spaces at inadequate times. This has created more regular instruction, teaching in large groups and in sectional groups of instruments, and even allowed some individual instruction. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Riley says the move has created a good problem, some growing numbers.
And now you fast forward to 5 years later, that first group that did that are now ninth graders in the high school. And that ninth grade group, in both cases, the band and the orchestra, is much larger than the groups ahead of them, the 10th, 11th, and 12th graders, that over the next several years will leave.
By about, what, 50 kids?
But it's about double. Each class now is maybe 30 to 40 kids that are participating in the band. You're looking at numbers like 60 to 70. That grows the band and it grows the orchestra to the point where our current space, if we continue to do things as we do now, it's not adequate for either program. So we looked at what it might take to remodel existing space. We didn't think that that was going to do the trick. So we began to look at, okay, what would it take for us to build an addition onto the high school? The southeast side of the high school, which is near our student parking lot, is the logical, ideal space. It's near the auditorium. It's near the current band room and the current orchestra room. So that is like a fine arts area. And we began to look at this space. And that's been a couple of years in the making. We're now at the point where we've crafted a plan for that. We have engaged our facilities committee and then engaging the teachers and the administration of the high school to start identifying what they need out of this space, and then a potential remodel of the current band room to accommodate the growing orchestra, and then a remodel of the current orchestra room to house our chorus.
It creates a whole culture of fine arts kids.
It does. And that's one of the things that I think, as we started to look at this addition, was important to us, having that area that is almost designated as a fine arts area. And that's really important to the life of the high school. And you throw in the drama department with the productions that we've had over the years. Now we're setting this up to be a very good area for years to come. We want to make something that is large enough to accommodate the growing band, and we think we've got a footprint to do that. It's about double the size of the existing room, and then the existing band room will be certainly large enough to house the orchestra that's growing. So I'm excited about the opportunity that this presents.
Would you address the optics of planning a $7.5 million building project when worried about state funding?
Sure. We are a people business. We are in the, you know, everything goes to staffing and classrooms. And when I talk about that, I'm talking about teachers and other staff that are part of those buildings. That's about 80% of our budget. And that's the education fund. And that's where, when we talk about challenges, that's the main fund for District 87. I know there's a lot of discussion about transportation funds and how that is very difficult, and that affects us as well. But the funds that I'm talking about are building funds, and they are not commingled with the education fund or transportation fund or other funds for that matter. And so we have debt, and that over time, what we do is we pay off that debt and we refinance and we do things to be able to maintain our buildings and put new roofs on at an appropriate time, make sure that we're taking care of our HVAC systems and all that infrastructure.
So how does the timing work so that there won't be any further burden to taxpayers?
Over time, we consistently look at trying to maintain our debt so many years out, and we're looking at about a 10 to 12 year time period to do that. This is that logical time to be able to do that. And the building bonds, as we look at the money that it would take to do that and what it would look like in terms of a tax rate, because that's what people tend to understand better, we don't anticipate that this is going to increase our tax rate. It certainly would in the building bond fund, but what we'll be able to do is offset that by lowering the health, life, safety is one of the funds that we're looking at, lowering that levy. And that's assuming that we have no EAV growth, which I do believe will happen. And so I think that a combination of that EAV growth and maintaining that health, life, safety fund at a level that offsets that will maintain that rate at its current level. And you look down the road, okay, when might you do this again? Because we always have projects that we want to do or that need to be done. And there's a few that are out there, but there's only one real big remaining project that people would really like to see get done in the district, and that is the auditorium. And it still works well, and we maintain it well. We're actually replacing the lighting controls, which have given us a little bit of a problem in the last year or two, and that will get us down the road some period of time. So I think the next big project that I don't know if it will actually occur in my time, but certainly that's the one that we'll pay attention to after we get these projects done. I want to add that we haven't talked about it yet, but as part of this, and there's a large focus on the fine arts with these projects that are going on, we're also looking at replacing our natural turf on the field with artificial turf, and that's something that would be part of these projects. We have very limited green space for our teams and other activities to participate in, so that will give us the ability to bring our boys and girls soccer program back to our own field and our own facilities. It will allow us to have our PE classes out there, our band to be able to get more time out in that field. That's all about bringing our kids back and getting more time on that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Barry Riley, the superintendent of District 87. Turf is two-edged, though. Yes, it's more usable. It's more durable. You can use it at more seasons, even when slightly wet. You can, without worrying about tearing up the sod and making it into a mud pit. But it can be harder on kids' joints. And in fact, there was a big hullabaloo in the last couple years about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team objecting to playing on turf and being scheduled on turf with the injury potential there when the men's team was scheduled on natural fields.
Yeah, we've actually engage our architects to look at various studies, and there's one that's come out of the state of Washington. And these are not tied to companies that make artificial surfaces. So we've been very careful and meticulous about looking at the sub-base when you start getting into the nitty-gritty of what you put underneath the actual surface of the turf that the athletes are on that addresses those issues. And I'm confident that the because we've paid careful attention to that, that the type of subsurface that we put in there, there's a, and I can't think of the name of it, but there's an additional absorption layer that is specifically to address what you're talking about there. And the study has found no difference between natural surface and the artificial surface utilizing that type of product underneath. And so I want folks to know that we're certainly aware of that and paying attention to the underneath of that. And I'm not, to me, the artificial turf, for it makes sense for District 87. It may not make sense for other places. We do not have a dedicated soccer space. And when you try, and we used to years ago put our soccer program on the field where we're playing football, and the wear and tear, we could never get that turf to take and maintain in a way that we could realistically expect to play on a surface that was even safe for kids. You think about the potentials for injuries. We had that issue, and with an artificial surface, it'll actually allow us to go right up to the track. It engages a more wide area that allows for the IHSA, you know, requirements to be able to host the regional sectionals, that sort of thing, and that was important to us. But the real important thing to me is that we get all of our kids on there and we get much more time and use out of that surface.
How much will the turf portion cost?
The turf portion of that will be right around $1 million of that 7.5. You expect a lifespan out of that of 10 to 12 years, so we'll make sure that we're taking care of that. When you look at the amount of money that we put into the field over that same time frame in terms of the making sure that you're fertilizing it, you're aerating it, you're mowing it, you are painting the lines, the labor that goes into that, that's probably about a $300,000+ expense over that 10 to 12 year period. I'm not here to say that by putting in turf, we're going to save money. That's not what this is about. This is about providing opportunities for kids. Once you get past that initial phase, that sub-base is in and all that is left over the next time when you have to replace that turf, that top layer is about equal to that expense if you were to maintain a natural field over those 10 to 12 years. But we wouldn't be able to do this if it was not a part of this larger package.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley also tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker that architect Russell Francois will share his concepts for the addition with the board and the public, the second board meeting during the month of May.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And it's Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Just ahead, it's a strawberry edition of GLT's Grow. That's coming up during Sound Ideas. There's an old joke that goes, a prison guard asks an inmate what he's in for, and the inmate replies, talking. Well, according to Regent University Law Professor James Duane, it's no laughing matter. Duane says even innocent people sometimes get convicted of crimes based on information they themselves provide to police. His video, Don't Talk to the Cops, has received millions of YouTube views. Duane will speak tonight at Illinois State University. He tells GLT's Judy Valente, no one should talk to the police on a criminal matter, even as a witness, without the aid of a lawyer.
The problem is that you don't know what you're up against. The police are not required in any way to put their cards on the table and to tell you what they really suspect and what they really intend. And they are skillful and highly trained in ways of getting you to admit things that can be used to help convict you even if you're innocent.
Now, I should say you hold this opinion not just for people who are suspected of a crime and may be called into the police station. You're talking about people who are witnesses, anybody.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, a lot of people, when they hear me give them this advice, they frequently make the mistake of thinking that, well, it would be different, right, if I'm not a suspect, if I'm just a victim, that'd be different, right? And the answer, unfortunately, no, it isn't. I wish I could say that our legal system required the police to be honest with you about what their intentions and expectations are. But that's not the way it is. The police sometimes will lie to you, and they'll say that we know you weren't involved. We know you had nothing to do with this. We know you're not a murderer, man. And they'll say, but we want to use you to help prosecute the other ones who were there. So you've got to tell us what you saw while you were there. And tragically, far too many people take the bait, and they think they can trust the police. They start giving information that they think will be used to prosecute somebody else, and then they find that the evidence is actually used against them as well.
A point you make in your book and in your many talks is that the police are actually trained to sort of almost get you talking, get you maybe to incriminate yourself.
Oh, and they're very good at it, too. Sometimes they'll do it by exaggerating the strength of their case against you. They'll say, we know you were there. We've got a video that proves you were there, and your fingerprints have already been identified from the scene. And your friend, Rocky, he's down the hall right now spilling his guts out, and he says you were there, and he says you're the one who pulled the trigger. And by the way, unbeknownst to you, every word of this is false, because down the hall they're lying to Rocky and saying that you're the one who's blaming him, you follow? And sometimes people, even innocent people, under these circumstances, when they hear this kind of thing, they think, oh my God, I don't know how this could be true. I know I'm innocent. I can't believe these people are telling them these things. But if that's what the police have got on me, then I'm screwed. So maybe I better just do what I can to work out the best deal I can. And then even if they don't confess, they'll at least admit that they were there, and they've just given the prosecutor maybe a crucial piece of evidence that they wouldn't have otherwise had.
But there are a lot of people who would say, I'm innocent, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm just going to tell the police everything I know. You say that's not a good idea either.
No, unfortunately, it isn't. The book I wrote, You Have the Right to Remain Innocent, gives numerous examples of real-world innocent people who got themselves convicted of crimes they didn't commit, and some of them because of nothing that the police had other than truthful information that they gave to the police. One example, Michael Morton was a man who was tragically the victim of a horrible crime. Some intruder broke into his home and murdered his wife while he was gone away to work. And he was terribly bereaved when he heard the horrible news. And, of course, like almost anybody in his position, he thinks, well, I'll tell the police everything I know. And he gave them all kinds of information. And tragically, the information that he gave them, even though it was true, was used to actually convict him of the crime that we later learned through DNA evidence he never even committed. A man named Glenn Ford, who was convicted in New Orleans, Louisiana, and sentenced to death. He spent more than 30 years on death row before it was recently revealed that he was totally innocent, and the police had no evidence against him except information that he gave them. And many of your listeners are thinking, how could that be? How could you possibly get yourself convicted if you're innocent and you tell the truth? Sometimes, unfortunately, for reasons you have no control over, you might become the victim of an absolutely terrible but tragic coincidence. In the case of Michael Morton, for example, he confessed to the police that the night before somebody else broke into his house and murdered his wife, he and his wife had had a mild disagreement and a fight that night before. And the police and the prosecutor and eventually the jury concluded that was the evidence of his motive to commit the crime. They thought, how likely is it that somebody else is going to break into the house the day after you happen to have a fight with your wife? They thought that was too far-fetched, but we now know that's what happened. The better course is to keep your mouth shut. Then you and your lawyer will never have to try to explain to the jury these terrible coincidences that they won't even know about if you don't tell them about these details.
Well, this whole issue of keeping your mouth shut, you and I and everyone has heard people take the Fifth Amendment, the famous Fifth Amendment. I refuse to testify. I refuse to talk on the grounds that it may incriminate me. And your first reaction, your human nature reaction, is to say this person has something to hide. This person must be guilty.
As a result of a couple of recent decisions, it's gotten to the point where the Fifth Amendment has now become what I call the right that dare not speak its name. Because if you tell the police I'm taking the Fifth or I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me, there's more and more recent case law that makes it easier than ever before, sometimes, for the police and the prosecutor to persuade the judge that the jury should be allowed to learn about that fact. And at that point, for goodness sake, they'll essentially argue that your invocation of this constitutional privilege was tantamount to a confession, which is highly unfair and highly misleading. But the better way to avoid that problem now is don't even mention your right to remain silent. Just tell the police you want to exercise your right to a lawyer under the Sixth Amendment. Take the Sixth, we might say.
Tell the police,
sure, I'll talk to you. No problem, but I just want to have a lawyer here first. That's all. Just get me a lawyer first, and then we'll talk.
Well, let's talk about some routine encounters that people have with the police. Most of those are traffic stops, basically.
Yeah.
So you're pulled over. Should you not speak to the police officer when you're pulled over, or how should you react?
Great question. I'm glad you asked. No, that's a different situation. As I mentioned in the book, this advice that I'm giving you doesn't apply in the same way to a routine traffic stop for a lot of obvious reasons. The most obvious is that when it comes to routine traffic infractions like speeding or not wearing your seatbelt, the police have a lot of discretion whether to show you a little mercy and let you go with a warning this time. And whether they decide to exercise that discretion has a great deal to do with whether they think you're being suitably respectful, remorseful, and contrite. And so I definitely recommend. I mean, when I've been pulled over by the police for speeding, I would definitely answer the questions. I would talk to them. I'd be very respectful and so forth. But when the police tell you they're investigating a murder or arson or kidnapping, forget about it. You can't talk to them about those things under any circumstances.
Let me take it a step further on these traffic stops. The police officer stops you for not signaling before you make your turn. But then pretty soon he's saying, can we search the car? Can we do a body search? Possibly looking for drugs, I would imagine. What about in those cases? Do you say no? At what risk do you say no?
Yes, you say no. You be as polite as you possibly can. Don't be disrespectful in any way. But let the police know that, no, I will not agree to let you search the vehicle. I know I will not consent to a body search or any other sort of search.
Are you setting yourself up then for resisting arrest or getting the charge, getting some sort of a charge?
Hopefully not. I mean, if the police officers are honest men and women of integrity, they cannot legally arrest you just because you chose to assert your constitutional rights. Now, I don't want to sound naive, let's be honest. The reality is that not all police officers are men and women of unimpeachable integrity. Most of them are. I hope the vast majority of them are. But we know for a fact that some of them are a little less scrupulous, and there is a risk that if you tell the police that you're exercising your rights, the worst among them might become incensed, outraged, offended. They'll take it as a slight to their authority, and they may hold it against you. Worst case, they may actually subject you to physical violence. The good news is that officers who are that unethical and that dishonest, I hope, are very, very few and far between. But the bad news is, if you ever find yourself falling into the clutches of a police officer like that, there's not much you can do to eliminate the risk that they're going to make up some sort of lie about you.
But if everyone just clammed up, you know, didn't talk to police if they were called as a witness or brought in, wouldn't it make it very hard then to solve crimes? Wouldn't it be a much longer process then to find out who really is guilty?
In the short run, yes, it would definitely pose a significant impediment to law enforcement, without a doubt, yes. Because the reality is, right now, an enormous percentage of all criminal cases are cleared and closed on the basis of confessions or other statements made by the defendant. You know, a good friend of mine, a prosecutor, has once said to me that, she said, don't tell too many people about their right to remain silent, she said, because I'll never be able to clear all my cases. Mm-hmm. And which is why so many people say, well then, why tell people about the Fifth Amendment at all? Why not just let all these guilty people continue to talk themselves in a jail cell? That's where they belong. The problem is that these methods of investigation have proven to be too effective. They work on the innocent and the guilty.
Talk about that, the scope of the number of people who have been set free by, say, the Innocence Project.
Hundreds. Yeah, that's right. Hundreds of people have been freed by the Innocence Project. People who were convicted, many of them, by the way, on the basis of information and statements that they voluntarily supplied to the police. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. No sane observer believes that we've found all the innocent people who are behind bars and we've got them all out now. Sure, the guilty ought to be convicted, but the innocent need to be acquitted. Innocent people should not be going to jail for crimes they didn't commit.
Well, it's certainly an important conversation. You're trying to get started here. We've been talking with James Duane. He is a professor in the law school at Regent University in Virginia Beach. Thanks so much for talking about this.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
I'm Judy Valente.
James Duane says there are more than 10,000 laws just in the federal criminal code and thousands of additional local laws, so that many citizens often don't even know when they're breaking a law. For most people, though, the most frequent encounters with police involve routine traffic stops. Last year, Illinois State University's Criminal Justice Sciences Department studied traffic stops in Normal and found that an inordinate number involved drivers under the age of 26. Criminal justice student Adam Kinross says many of those stops are made for minor traffic violations, but that police then seek to search the cars of younger drivers or bring in canines to sniff for drugs. Kinross says many ISU students don't know they have a right to refuse these searches. He tells GLT's Judy Valente that's one of the reasons why he invited James Duane to speak on campus tonight.
A lot of it is minor traffic stops. So in class, we've learned about the idea of profiling, or we've learned about the idea of police, you know, making minor traffic stops for minor traffic violations when they really have another cause at mind. You know, maybe they're worried about drugs, maybe they're worried about a person who's driving under the influence. So they'll pull someone over for a minor reason, such as, you know, their license plate tags are expired, or they turned into the far lane, is something I've been pulled over for in normal before.
In other words, you're making a right-hand turn and you go to the far left lane.
Yes, you go to the far left lane instead of, you know, nearest to nearest, like they teach you in driver's ed. And they'll pull people over for this. You know, there's a certain extent where when you do this too often, and a normal police department pulls over 20,000 people per year, 14,000 of those stops, or roughly 14,000 of those stops, end in warnings, which means, you know, they were probably pulling someone over for a very minor reason and checking for any sort of higher level, you know, crime, whether that be drugs or DUI or something like that. And as soon as they find that that's not going on, or find that that's not what they were, you know, originally going to find, then they'll let the person go and leave them with a warning. And hopefully that warning is enough to make sure that that person doesn't turn into the far lane, or make sure they have their license plate re-registered and on time and everything.
Do you know of any examples of students, of friends of yours, who in fact incriminated themselves by saying too much to police?
I don't know any personal examples of this, or any close friends of mine that I have to deal with it. And I'd say that's a good thing, but I do know that there are plenty of examples.
What are you hoping that Professor Duane can impart to the students, other than they should watch what they say when they're interrogated?
I really hope that he instills that the value of just because you remain silent does not mean you're guilty. You know, just because you refuse to incriminate yourself with the police or make statements to the police, or because you decide to lawyer up if you're being interrogated, that does not make you guilty. That's not an admission of guilt. And I think our founding fathers would roll over in their grave if they felt that this country had gotten to a point where if people were refusing to make statements, or for people were exercising their constitutional rights that they have, that they were looked at as guilty by the public or looked at as guilty by the police. And that's not where we should be.
Police would say for their part that they don't stop anyone, they don't pull anyone over unless someone is doing something wrong, unless someone is breaking the law or potentially breaking the law. I mean, that's part of their job.
Right. And also in part two of the Don't Talk to Cops viral video YouTube series on YouTube, there was a former police officer who was given the chance to talk, and he spoke about how they can drive behind someone for half a mile to a mile, and at any given time, that person will probably commit a traffic offense. And because there are so many rules and regulations, there are so many laws. Another point that he makes in the book, there are, I think it was 10,000 to 15,000 laws in our legal code that are written down. And there's no way for any single person to know every single law. He talks about possessing a certain size of crab that a fisherman may have no idea is illegal. But, you know, if he gets caught with it, then he's going to get in trouble for it. And it's a matter of, yes, you know, it's in good faith what they're trying to do. They're trying to keep our streets clean, and they're trying to protect our citizens. And I understand that. But it's when they push it to a certain extent where they're having 53, you know, traffic stops a day, which is an extremely high number, you know, a very high number or high level of contact with normal citizens, where it gets to a point where it's just like, how much is really needed? How much is really necessary? And I understand they're just doing their jobs. And I am so appreciative to all our police, all our firefighters that do their job every single day. And that's why I've wanted to go into law enforcement for so long myself. But I do think there's a difference between good policing and between near harassing a community, or and I'm not saying that that's necessarily what's going on here, but just make sure that you're interacting with your community on a good basis too, and that your citizens know that you're looking out for their best interests and not just trying to follow a police manual of what they're trained to do, and that's to get, you know, build good cases and hand over an easy win for a prosecutor. That's what they're trained to do. Can we reform our criminal justice system? Can we reform our police training and our police academies to a point where they're not just trying to build a good case, but trying to get to what the actual truth is?
You're a criminal justice science major. What do you plan to do? Do you plan to go into the law enforcement side, or do you plan to go into the defense attorney side?
I've been very conflicted about this my whole life. So I've always wanted to go into law enforcement. I always enjoyed the idea of being a police officer and being able to help keep our community safe. And But the more I've studied and the more I've gotten into both sides and all aspects of the criminal justice system here, which, side note, I think is so great about ISU, that it's not just a law enforcement major, but it's a criminal justice major, meaning you're exposed to so much more. You know, you're exposed to corrections, you're exposed to probation, you're exposed to policing, the courts, everything. And the more I learn and the more I get into this field of study, the more I see that there's a lot more to it than just policing.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Adam Kinross. He is a criminal justice major here at ISU, and he's talking about Don't Talk to the Cops, a video that went viral on YouTube by Professor James Duane. Thank you so much for talking about this.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Judy Valente.
Adam Kinross organized tonight's talk by Law Professor James Duane on speaking to the police. The talk's open to the public. It starts at 6:30 in rooms 235 of Edwards Hall on the ISU campus. On those traffic stops of students in Normal, Police Chief Rick Bleichner has said in the past his department doesn't target any one group. He said students might be pulled over more often because they spend more time in their cars and are often out later than older drivers. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, you'll hear a series of GLT interviews on the policing process. We all hear buzzwords like community policing, hotspot policing, and problem-oriented policing. What do they all mean, and how do they affect you? You'll gain some insight with the backdrop of the local law enforcement scene. You'll hear from industry consultants and also researchers, and from Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner, who must carry out the serve and protect mantra that police officers tout. That's all coming tomorrow during Sound Ideas here on GLT. I'm Willis Kern. Just ahead, it's a preview of this weekend's Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert that's coming up. From jams to jellies to shortcakes, strawberries lend themselves to many dishes, and the best way to go is homegrown. Patrick Murphy has some advice on how to grow tasty strawberries in this edition of GLT's Grow.
One of the most popular backyard crops is strawberries. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
What a day. What a day.
What a day. And today on GLT's Grow, Murph has advice for us on getting a garden load of strawberries. They're wonderful to have fresh. They're wonderful to, you know, to make in at preserves. Strawberries are fabulous.
They are fabulous. And in your opener, you mentioned that they're popular. They actually are the number one small fruit in America.
Wow.
Small fruits include things like the blueberry and the raspberry and blackberry, of course. And strawberries, in addition to being the most popular, they have three different ways that you can approach growing them. And it really kind of depends on what your goal is. So you have a June-bearing strawberries that produce a crop in a 2 to 3 week period in the spring. So that's a one-time shot, okay? And then you have your ever-bearing strawberries that they produce three whole sets of flowers and fruit throughout a spring, summer, and fall growing season. That's really the best one, okay? And then day neutral is one that produces continually through the growing season. So that's a one or two here or there. So if you compare all three, you know, you get a whole bunch of berries early. And if you have a berry problem, that's a good one to consider. You know, berries now, berries now. And then ever-bearing, you get three batches, you know. So with all the other stuff you're handling in your garden, it's probably good to have three batches so you can freeze or can. And then day neutral, you get this sprinkling all season long. So I think if you're a salad or a gourmand type person, that might be the one for you.
Okay.
So you can see, you can figure out.
Can you grow all of them?
You could, but you'd be wasting a lot of space in your garden.
Oh. So,
and here's how I know that.
Okay.
So there are three ways to grow the three types of strawberries also. And I didn't plan that, but it just worked out that way. The matted row is where we have our plants 18 to 30 inches apart, so a foot and a half to 2.5 feet apart, with the rows being 3 to 4 feet apart. And the little daughter plants that come off the mother plants, you would not worry about those. You would just let those grow down to the edge of your row. And then the spaced row, The daughter plants, you would want to kind of cut those back from the mother, no more than 4 inches away from the mother plant. And then there's a hill system, and this works for all types, but the rows have 2 to 4 plants with a 2-foot walking aisle in between. And spaced hill and the hill spaced row and hill system both require you to go down and kind of pinch away the runners to a certain distance.
Uh-huh.
So one, the spaced row, the little strawberries kind of cluster and mat together.
Right.
And in a smaller space, and the hill is actually a hill, also similar to a potato.
Can I grow strawberries in a pot?
That would be difficult to do.
Okay.
You could do it, but there would be, the damping off is a condition that you have trouble with strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
Tomatoes are similar; they have that condition. So it's getting them started. Once you get some started, you might be able to get away with doing it in a large pot. The pot would have to be one that doesn't narrow to the bottom so that it drains really well.
Oh, good point.
So a lot of pots have that. All strawberries, regardless of the style, they like a 5.5 to 6.5 range on the pH scale.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week it's strawberries 101, and they have a particular pH that they're looking for to be happy.
They like that, and there's a for every 1,000 square feet of strawberries, you're going to need a 10-20-20 type of fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to over-fertilize strawberries because then they become very vegetative and they don't have as many flowers which turn into strawberries.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want
right?
the flowers.
So you want the flowers and the strawberries. You don't want stems and leaves. So a good way to avoid doing that is you compost the area that you're going to grow your strawberries in the year before.
Okay.
So you could back dig. We've talked about back digging that. Grow Corporate loves back digging, and so do I. And it's a great way to add that compost in without having to rent a rototiller.
Yeah.
That's a great thing to do. And weeding is really important. Regardless of the type of strawberry or the approach, the first 2 to 3 weeks, I would say the first month, it's really important that you keep those rows and those spaces between your plants scraped clean with the hoe. Don't turn the soil over all the time in between. Scrape it with the hoe or mm-hmm. plunge it with some kind of dandelion lance or something. If you're constantly turning the soil in between the strawberry plants, you're going to interfere with the runners and the root growth.
Gotcha.
And you're going to motivate weed seeds that have been lazily laying around.
We don't want to be motivating weeds.
Waiting for a chance to come to life, and that's sometimes all that's needed. So if you can keep the strawberries real clean for mm-hmm. as little as 2 weeks, as much as a month, you're kind of letting them take over their own little domain, and there's not much that can break that once they've established. So that's very important.
You know, my mother used to grow strawberries, but half of the berries ended up in the bellies of the birds.
Oh,
the
yeah.
birds love the strawberries. I mean, is throwing netting over our strawberry plants, is that at all helpful?
I think it's helpful, but and the way you described it kind of highlights the attention to detail and what's important there.
Okay.
Throwing the net over the strawberries, think of yourself as a bird, right?
Mm-hmm.
Creature with no arms. He just lands on the net, reaches his little face through one of the holes, and has a strawberry. Versus you could put a couple stakes out, maybe with a bucket or a water jug on top of them, and throw the net over that.
Okay.
So, well, then they can't land on it.
So it's more tented.
It's just up off of there. And another thing is the net won't stop the rabbits, because the rabbits and the ground varmints, they like the strawberries too. But if you make the little net there so that they can't just easily go right through the tiny holes that make up the net.
Mm-hmm.
The holes vary in the nets, I understand.
I'd be like buying one that's mesh, you know, to keep everybody out.
And I've seen it done where people just kind of, they had a raised bed, so they put like a post in each corner, and then they stretch the net tight over the top of it. And mm-hmm. if a bird did land on there, it was this little mattress trampoline type effect, and the bird would just fly away.
Oh, how interesting.
And there was no opportunity for the bird to reach down through the holes because of the space between the net. But, you know, what works just as well are the moving scarecrows are great.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, with the small fruits, the birds are a big deal. And a big way to kind of fight that is when you're out checking those weeds the first 2 to 4 weeks, you're coming out to the garden, the animals will figure that out. They'll figure out when to visit
that
the garden
that you're
going to
be
there.
Somebody hanging around, and that maybe.
So you got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
If especially, you know, if you live in a spot where you're feeding the critters like we do at our house, you know, hey, you can have this, but you can't have that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Could you distract them from that with some bird seed or
That's
something?
That's something we need to have a whole other show about,
well,
really.
Let's do that.
You know, we got your Irish Spring soap technique, you got the scarecrows, you got explosives.
Ooh.
That's for really hostile birds. Just kidding.
We don't use explosives on grow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
and your favorite variety, real quick, Murph, of strawberry?
I think that the everbearing is the best way to grow, the best way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you get them kind of predictable in little groups. And they're attractive. They look nice. They kind of grow like a ground cover with flowers on them.
Okay, sounds beautiful. Thank you so much, Murph. Next week on GLT's Grow, club root and how to deal with it. We're looking for gardening questions or problems. Murph would love to take those on. Just go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and send it along to us. It's possible that Murph will pick your question to answer on the air. And here it is, springtime. There's a lot of gardening issues out there. We'd love to hear from you. So you just submit those questions at wglt.org/grow.
And you can download the Grow podcast. You can do it at iTunes or at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at JustinMBoyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Dick File. I've been a contributing listener to GLT for almost 50 years. I appreciate and rely on the news coverage. I think part of the reason the reporting is so enjoyable is because it's not interrupted by commercials that often try to interest me in products that I really don't care about. This fund drive is underway, and it's time for you to renew or to make a first-time contribution. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
We are determined to keep fund drive interruptions to a minimum, so we're only asking for your support during our regular breaks. Please do your part now. Give a little or give a lot. Make a one-time contribution or become an ongoing contributor. You can renew your support or make your first-time contribution. Help us meet the $95,000 goal and pay for the programs you rely on. Click on donate at WGLT.org. I'm Willis Kern at Sound Ideas. One of America's greatest classical music composers is George Gershwin. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra plays an entire Gershwin concert Friday at the BCPA in Bloomington. The ISO will be conducted by Vladimir Kulenovic, one of the finalists for the job of music director. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Kulenovic starts by talking about Gershwin's connections to French composer Maurice Ravel.
Gershwin was a big fan of Ravel's music, and actually through their acquaintance and musical friendship, they both influenced each other in various ways. Gershwin originally contacted Ravel, trying to become his student. He was a very successful composer himself, but coming from basically from big band, from jazz, from musical theater. He actually wanted to apply himself seriously to the realm of classical music and contacted Ravel via mail to become his student. And Ravel, of course, appreciated the request and said, okay, I do accept this, but Mr. Gershwin, can you please tell me, just answer one question for me. How much did you make on your last commission? And Gershwin wrote back with a number, after which Ravel said, Mr. Gershwin, I think I should be taking lessons from you. The two musical colleagues actually did connect in Paris. Helped Gershwin reach Nadia Boulanger, who told Gershwin that it's a much better idea for Gershwin to be a first-rate Gershwin than second-rate Ravel.
she was a big name in teaching composition.
Yes. She taught there in Copland.
60, 70 years. Yeah. She was on everybody's radar.
Yes. And Aaron Copland studied with her and scores of other composers, as well as my solfège teacher from Juilliard, Mary Anthony Cox, who was her assistant for a number of years in Paris. And so I actually have lineage dating back to Nadia and her prolific class, but she did not accept Gershwin simply because he was too good to create it.
His musical voice is not susceptible to tampering.
Gershwin was a genius. It's very safe to say that. Not only did he bring jazz into classical music, but as you learn from our program, his variations on I Got Rhythm actually influenced jazz. These progressions actually were pushing the envelope in jazz, and Dizzy Gillespie and others actually followed the footsteps of Gershwin.
In what way? Is it sprung rhythms or?
Yeah. I got rhythm, you got rhythm. You know, so this rhythm, actually, the harmonic progressions that are underlying, became a staple for a lot of improvisations that you hear pretty much as one of the main staples of jazz in the decades following Gershwin. Not to mention the Rhapsody in Blue, which we have in our program. This was a piece with big band. The orchestral arrangement followed later on. Gershwin himself played the piano part, as he did on many occasions. And this is a piece that actually, symbolically, it was conceived on the train ride from New York to Boston. And itself, it was a transition from jazz into classical music. So it Rhapsody was itself a train, a journey of one creative composer who actually single-handedly created the United American sound of music and actually made a bridge between jazz and classical music that was not there before him. And that bridge was actually also in Ravel's music. Jazz influenced Ravel as well.
It is a big, big reputational work for him that established him as a major composer. How much do we owe Gershwin for this, and how much do we owe Ferdig Ruffé, the orchestrator?
We are repaying those debts forever. These were visionaries. Ruffé actually, he has the credit for facilitating this piece in the repertoire. If it remained in the big band repertoire, it never would be so popular, and it would not have had the opportunity to revolutionize the concert hall as it did. Also, Gershwin continued, I mean, he's by any account a very, very serious composer. When you look at the score of Porgy and Bess, I mean, this is an extremely intricate
somewhat piece. Later than
yeah, somewhat later, of course.
In the 30s rather than exactly, 26 20,
yeah,
or so.
Yeah. You know, even the American Paris, I mean, these are very serious works. And you can see that Gershwin had a quality. I mean, he made a lot of money. He had a great career. He was very famous. But his best quality as a person, composer, was his humility. He was friends with Sergei Rachmaninoff, who also helped him with the Rhapsody in Blue. Of course, his friendship with Ravel. He played tennis with Arnold Schoenberg. He even asked Schoenberg for lessons. I don't know where he got that, because what could he learn from a 12-tone composer?
I was going to say, did they count? It couldn't have been just 15, 30, 40 game. It had to be something based on 12 tones for the scoring in tennis.
Exactly. So, but this piece actually, I think you should not be too pedantic with this. It should actually, even though it's a very serious piece, have a sense of an improvisation. Spontaneity that I think it's as much its character as the masterful way in which it was composed.
You can meet guest conductor Vladimir Kalinovic and guest artist Ian Parker at Concert Comments, 6:45 p.m. in the BCPA Ballroom Friday. The ISO performance that night is at 8 o'clock. Kalinovic spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. This is the closing passages of Rhapsody in Blue, performed by the Philharmonic Orchestra. At our website, WGLT.org, you can find individual stories and interviews heard during Sound Ideas. Thanks to Charlie Schlenker, Laura Kennedy, and Judy Valente. And thanks to you. Make your contribution now to support this show and this station at WGLT.org. You can also post about what you hear on GLT at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. You can use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Wee Kern. We're all at WGLT.org. Thank you for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University.